July 24, 1869. We examine the rapids below. Large rocks have fallen from the walls, great angular blocks which have rolled down the talus and are strewn along the channel. We are compelled to make three portages in succession, the distance being less than 3/4 of a mile, with a fall of 75 feet. Among these rocks, in chutes, whirlpools, and great waves, with rushing breakers and foam, the water finds its way, still tumbling down. We stop for the night only 3/4 of a mile below the last camp. Darkness is coming on, but the waves are rolling with crests of foam so white they almost give a light of their own. Nearby, a chute of water strikes the foot of a great block of limestone 50 feet high, and the waters pile up against it and roll back. Where there are sunken rocks, the water heaps up in mounds, or even in cones. At a point where rocks come very near the surface, the water forms a chute above, strikes, and is shot up 10 or 15 feet and piles back in gentle curves as in a fountain, and on the river tumbles and roars. The two prospectors never got through at all. Near the very beginning, their boat overturned, cast them out, and went down the river on its own. The men managed to get ashore still alive. But they could not agree on the best way back to human settlement. One hiked up a side canyon and struck off west across country toward the hamlet of Hanksville, some 40 miles away by airline. The second man, thinking it wiser to stay close to water, trudged northeast along the Colorado back toward Moab, their starting point. He had twice as far to go, taking into account the meanders of the river, but was in no danger of dying from thirst. Neither had any food. But the first man had all the luck. Soon after the organized search began, he was spotted from the air and promptly rescued. While his former comrade struggled on mile after mile and day after day through the willow thickets and over the talus debris on the river's shore. Search parties in powerboats cruised down the river and back again, but incredibly failed to see him. He saw them, but was too exhausted to shout, lacked matches to start a fire, and apparently was too frightened or too delirious to stay at one spot and construct some kind of distress signal. "They never looked in the right direction," he would later explain bitterly, "and therefore crawled on over the rocks under the desert sun, now and then catching a lizard which he ate raw and whole. Tasted like tuna," he reported. Finally, he was discovered 10 days after the search began near an abandoned miner's shack below Dead Horse Point. They found him sitting on the ground hammering feebly at an ancient can of beans, trying to open the can with a stone. Hospitalized for exposure, shock, and malnutrition, he urged that the entrance to Cataract Canyon be somehow chained off, closed forever to human exploration. Some present-day Moabites have suggested that the federal government take atomic bombs and blast a straight deep channel through Cataract Canyon so that they, the Moabites, can pilot their new cabin cruisers without hazard all the way down to the new Glen Canyon Reservoir. In all those years of feverish struggle, buying and selling, cheating and swindling, isolation, loneliness, hardship, danger, sudden fortune and sudden disaster, there is one question about this search for the radiant treasure, the hidden splendor, which nobody ever asked. It is necessary, therefore, to relate one more story concerning the uranium strike, a story based on events which may or may not have actually happened, but which all who tell it will swear is true. Among the thousands drawn to the canyon country by the publicity of the boom was one Albert T. Husk of Star Route 2, Box 17, Flat Rock, Texas. He brought with him his young and pleasant-looking, if somewhat thin and anxious, second wife, his 11-year-old son Billy Joe, and two little girls younger than the boy. He had left behind a 70-acre farm in the East Texas Pinelands, a Fordson tractor and lesser implements, two purebred blue-tick coon dogs, and his father, A.T. Husk Sr., to look after things. All except the old man had been mortgaged to finance the hunt for new wealth and a new life, for Albert Husk was a man of vision. The Husk family rattled into Moab one blazing hot day in June, riding in a Jeep pickup, which looked as if it had been rolled down a mountainside, and towing, without safety chain, an antique house trailer of the type which only sheepherders live in these days. Plywood and tar paper, a thin coat of aluminum paint, tires worn down to the threads. Purchased from and guaranteed by a dealer in Lubbock named Sharp. Husk found a vacant spot in the mouth of Courthouse Wash, where, under a splendid cottonwood tree, he set up his base camp. There was a spring nearby, with a pool below it as large as a bathtub, where his new wife could bathe and wash her flaxen hair. With two charges of blasting powder, one of which failed to go off, Husk excavated a pit toilet in the alluvium, he was in a hurry, and slung a tent over it. The Baptist Church was only 5 miles away in the heart of downtown Moab, behind T.C. Tracy's gas station, but once his family had been established in their new home, Husk, a somewhat indifferent Christian, went straight to the Club 66, where the smoke-dense air crackled with radioactivity and the smell of honest miners' sweat. Here he met his benefactor, a man known as Charles Chuck Graham, or Ingram. The name has been obscured by the many variants of the narrative. Mr. Graham, like Husk, was also a newcomer to the Moab area, though not so new as the latter. In fact, he was already pretty well dug in. He owned a flying service, light planes and helicopters for hire or charter, carried a pilot's license, and operated as well the only car and truck rental agency in town. An affable and helpful man, he quickly engaged Husk in a friendly conversation at the bar. From the bar they moved to a table in the corner, where Mr. Graham produced a large tectonic map, and explained to Husk as well as he could, for Husk had only the dimmest notions of geology, what the prospects were for making fresh uranium discoveries in the Colorado Plateau. It was soon made apparent to Husk that the better possibilities were already firmly tied up in claims and developments. Mr. Graham advised Husk that it might be wiser, in the long run, to return to Flat Rock and redeem his farm, rather than risk his, no doubt limited, assets in what would probably be a fruitless search for a fool's treasure. Husk allowed that the odds were against him, but declared fervently, over the second pitcher of beer, that he wasn't about to go all the way back to East Texas without even giving his luck a try. Mr. Graham then suggested to Husk that better than rambling off half-cocked into the outback, he should buy into a partnership with somebody who already controlled a likely group of claims. Husk requesting further information, Mr. Graham reluctantly conceded that he himself had a few such properties, including a very promising group of uranium claims along the San Rafael River. Mr. Graham explained that he planned to develop the claims himself sooner or later, but that the press of his other business had so far made it impossible. He would therefore be willing to take in a partner if the partner commenced the necessary location work. Husk was willing, even eager, and inquired as to the terms. Mr. Graham, however, insisted that Husk think it over and have a look at the claims before they discussed pecuniary details. He wanted Husk to be quite certain beforehand that he was getting his money's worth. He did not, he explained, wish to see any friend of his get into something over his head. Husk smiled and showed Mr. Graham the corner of a cashier's check from a bank in Flat Rock. He wasn't rich, he said, but he could take care of himself. Mr. Graham frowned and cautioned Husk against displaying his funds too openly in a place like the Club 66. Mormons, he implied, have few compunctions about separating a Gentile from his money. Husk said that Mr. Graham was a genuine Christian gentleman, if he ever seen one, and invited him home to meet the wife and kids. Mr. Graham accepted. Husk reeled out of the bar into the blinding sunlight, Mr. Graham following, and after some confusion led the way to the camp in Courthouse Wash. Mrs. Husk was pleased to make his acquaintance, and the children also took to Mr. Graham at once, except for Billy Joe, who was a very shy boy. Mr. Graham showed him his pilot's license, and that helped a little. Certainly Mrs. Husk was impressed. She invited Mr. Graham to stay for supper, and he did. He particularly enjoyed the mucilaginous green pods of the okra which Mrs. Husk had prepared, remarking that he'd been practically raised on that vegetable back in Oklahoma during his boyhood. He offered Mrs. Husk a cigarette and lit it for her with his slim butane lighter. Later, the children showed him the pool up in the canyon below the spring. An owl hooted softly, and little hog-nosed bats zigzagged through the twilight. Before leaving for the night, Mr. Graham and Husk agreed to meet the next morning for an inspection trip by air to the claims on the San Rafael. When he was gone, the Husk family discussed their new friend, and all agreed that he seemed like a very fine person. Again, except for the boy, who thought he smiled too much. The flight over the canyons next day was a success, though Husk, who'd never been up in an airplane before, got slightly airsick on the return. In order to land, Mr. Graham had to make 3 passes over the unpaved airstrip before some browsing cattle would get out of the runway. But during the flight over the canyons, he had shown Husk not only his own properties, but also several small uranium mines in the vicinity actually in operation. Yes, Husk could see for himself the test holes, the adits and tailings, the winding jeep roads along the verge of dizzying ledges. And as they flew over the claims, Mr. Graham switched on the scintillometer wired to a case of storage batteries which he carried in the plane, and pointed out to Husk the pointer readings on the dials, indicative, he explained, of radioactive minerals somewhere in the mesa below. It would be his partner's job, on the ground, to locate those deposits precisely. Husk nodded eagerly and stared so hard his eyes watered, trying to see through the lifeless rock the buried, slowly disintegrating hoard. Then Mr. Graham pulled up sharply to clear a bulging escarpment. Husk felt his stomach sink into his bowels. He saw the horizon rise in a queer way far up on his right, and to the left, where the earth had been a moment before, was only blue sky, empty space, a bottomless gulf. That evening, they made the deal. For a consideration of $2,250, half the amount of the cashier's check, Husk gained a 40% interest in Hot Rock Mountain Mineral Development Company, as they decided to call their joint enterprise. An agreement 4 pages long was drawn up by Mr. Graham's secretary, signed by both parties, notarized by the secretary, and witnessed formally by the grimy hand of a man in oily green coveralls who crawled out from beneath Mr. Graham's aircraft when needed. With his carbon copy of the contract in hand, Husk went home to give the good news to his wife. Early the next day, Husk went to work. Mr. Graham provided him with a Geiger counter and probe, a geologist's hammer, standard uranium ore samples, a canvas ore sack, and extra cans for water and gasoline. At first, Husk had wanted to take his wife and kids along to the San Rafael, but Mr. Graham talked him out of it, pointing out that the family would be much more comfortable in its present camp near the amenities and conveniences of Moab. He said that he would look after them in Husk's absence and furnish them transportation into town when needed. The claims lay far away beyond the rivers, more than 100 miles by road, including some 50 miles of jeep trail, and the last 10 miles where there was no road or trail at all. So Husk loaded his pickup with tools, bedrolls, and enough food for 2 weeks, said goodbye to his wife and little girls, and drove off, taking only the boy along. Late that afternoon, during the hottest part of the day, Mr. Graham left his office and strolled down the street to the Club 66. After a couple of beers, he got into his car and went for a drive. 5 miles north of town, he stopped his car under the shade of the big cottonwood at the outlet of Courthouse Wash. The sheepherder's trailer stood with its screen door sagging open. Flies drifted in and out, and a white butterfly with wilted wings rested on the dust of the doorstep. There seemed to be nobody home. Mr. Graham knocked on the trailer wall. Nobody answered, but he thought he heard the sound of laughing children in the distance. He walked slowly up the canyon through the stifling heat, keeping to the shady side. At the first turn, he halted. Through a screen of willows, he looked at the two little girls splashing in the water, and at Mrs. Husk, half undressed, sitting at the edge of the pool. Her long, straight yellow hair, wet now, hung before her eyes. Indolently, with languid grace, she was combing it. Mr. Graham watched for a few moments, then backed off quietly, returned to the trailer, and waited there. All summer long, Husk and his son toiled over the rocks above the trickling stream of the San Rafael. They struggled up the debris of talus slopes, clambered along ledges, pulled themselves up the boulder-choked defiles of side canyons. At every gray outcrop of Morrison and Shinarump, the uranium-bearing formations, they probed with a counter foot by foot, now and then getting a static of excitement from the instrument, and they hammered and picked at the rock and loaded their sack with specimens. During the middle of the day they rested in whatever shade they could find, under an overhang or juniper, sometimes under the truck itself, and in the evenings went painfully down to the stream to wash up a little and lug cans of water back up the trail. Much of the time they spent making a road for the truck, hacking through juniper stands, filling in washouts, or blasting a hole down through rim rock in order to reach a slope. At night they camped wherever they happened to be, cooking their supper over an open fire and sleeping in the bed of the truck for fear of scorpions and rattlesnakes, and rose before dawn to resume the hunt, covering as much ground as they could before the glare and withering heat of midday. About every 2 weeks, Husk and Billy Joe returned to Moab for fresh supplies and for repairs, parts, and sometimes new tires for the truck. Each time Husk showed Mr. Graham the samples he had collected. All of them proved to contain a little uranium or thorium, but none, according to the report of Mr. Graham's assayist, were rich enough to be of commercial value. Mr. Graham did his best to encourage Husk, bought him drinks at the Club 66, and staked him to new batteries for the Geiger counter. Husk said that what he really needed was a new truck. Mr. Graham laughed, patted him on the back, and reminded him that he'd soon be riding around in Cadillacs. Preoccupied, almost obsessed with his work, Husk was only dimly aware of the change in his wife's response to him. With each visit to the home camp, she seemed a little more irritable, more disinclined to intimacy, somehow more distant. She submitted to his lovemaking with indifference, sometimes with reluctance. Husk was faintly troubled, but grateful, on the other hand, that she seemed so unconcerned by the rapid reduction of their savings and the so far worthless results of his prospecting. Therefore, he did not attempt to question her, but returned to his search with anxious eagerness despite the heaviness in his heart. One afternoon, during the last week in August, Mr. Graham sat in his office checking the action of the small pistol which he kept in his desk. He was alone. He loaded a clip and slipped it into the pistol, drew the slide back, and pushed it forward, placing a round in the firing chamber. Carefully, he let the hammer down and put the pistol into the pocket of a light jacket which he sometimes wore. Taking the jacket, he went to his helicopter, filled the fuel tanks, climbed into the pilot's seat in the center of the cockpit, and started the engine. Husk and Billy Joe were cooking their supper over a fire of juniper sticks when they heard the thrashing racket of noise come over the edge of the mesa. The sun was down. The new half-moon hung nearly overhead. In the blend of sunset and twilight, they saw the flickering lights before they saw the machine itself coming like a bright metallic dragonfly out of the east and circling once, twice above them before landing. The gusts of wind blew sand and twigs into their fire, into the open pan of corned beef and beans. Billy Joe's new straw cowboy hat took off from his head, whirled toward the brink of the mesa, and sailed off into space. In silence, they watched the tall figure of Mr. Graham emerge from the helicopter's plastic bubble, stoop under the slow-turning blades of the prop, and walk toward them. Billy Joe did not clearly understand everything that followed during the hour or more of conversation around the campfire. He knew that his father was unhappy, even angry, with Mr. Graham, and the tone of the argument did not soften when Mr. Graham unzipped the left-hand pocket of his jacket and produced a half-pint of whiskey, which he passed to Billy Joe's father. Husk accepted the bottle and drank, but soon afterwards was saying things which made Mr. Graham sit very still, very quiet, with a look on his face which frightened the boy. And after a pause, Billy Joe heard Mr. Graham say a thing about his new mother, his father's new wife, that was strange and ugly. His father stood up suddenly and roared. He stepped straight through the flames of the fire toward Mr. Graham. And Mr. Graham, already standing, backing away, pulled the dark gleaming thing from his other jacket pocket, cocked it, thrust it forward. There was a flash of light and a small explosion. Billy Joe saw his father stop, grab at his stomach, and lunge again at Mr. Graham, who fired again. His father doubled forward, head close to his knees, and sank to the ground. Mr. Graham shot him a third time in the back. His father, gasping and clutching at his belly, rolled slowly over onto one side. Billy Joe stood up, wanting to speak. Mr. Graham shielded his eyes from the glow of the campfire and looked for him with the gun. "Where are you, Billy?" he said. The boy could not say a word, but his body, his legs, reacted for him. He stumbled backward, turned, ran madly into the gloom. He heard the gun go off, but felt nothing. He kept running and heard the heavy feet of Mr. Graham coming after him. He plunged through brush, through a tree's branches, and over the edge of a ravine. He felt himself falling, falling, then a stunning blow as he crashed into sand and went sliding and tumbling all the way down to the bottom of a great dune, all the way to the ravine floor. He tried to move, and a sickening jet of pain coursed through his shoulder. He lay still on his back in the shadows, looking up at the scarp over which he had fallen. There was Mr. Graham, silhouetted against the sky, walking back and forth, hunting for a way down. A few pale stars shone through the moonlight. The boy in the desert in the night waited in perfect silence for whatever might happen next. Breathing hard, for he was really somewhat out of shape, Mr. Graham went back to Husk's camp to get a flashlight. There he discovered that his partner was still alive, crawling inch by inch away from the now fading campfire toward the jeep truck. Mr. Graham paused, stepped carefully around Husk, and went to the truck, which was parked with chalked wheels on a slope above the rim of the mesa. Beyond that rim, the world dropped away at an angle of 90 degrees, down sheer for 800 feet or more, to a talus of broken slabs in the bottom of a side canyon of the San Rafael Canyon. Mr. Graham found a flashlight in the truck, also Husk's rifle. He sat down on the running board to rest, to regain his wind, and watched Husk crawling slowly toward him. When Husk was nearly close enough to reach the toes of his boots, Mr. Graham shot him again, this time in the head and with the rifle. He dragged the body into the cab of the truck and slammed shut the doors. He thought for a while, then opened a 5-gallon jerry can and poured gasoline over Husk's body and all over the interior of the cab. He found a second gasoline can, unscrewed the lid, and set it in the right-hand corner of the cab on the floor. Mr. Graham was sweating badly, his hands shaking, his chest painfully constricted. He was about to light a cigarette, but thought better of it. He sat down near the truck to rest for a while. Thinking carefully, Mr. Graham decided to ease the truck down close to the edge of the mesa, stop it there, and toss a match in on his partner before pushing the whole works over. The truck was parked parallel to the rim, not facing it. So Mr. Graham, after removing the rocks from in front of the wheels, climbed into the driver's seat, pushing Husk's legs out of the way, and automatically, out of habit, turned on the switch. He had almost stepped on the starter before he realized the danger. Without starting the motor, he disengaged the clutch, took the truck out of gear, and turned the wheels downhill. There was an awful lot of loose play in the steering. As the truck began to roll, Mr. Graham's right foot groped for the brake pedal, found it, and pushed it down to the floorboard without meeting the slightest hint of resistance. In sudden alarm, he grabbed for the parking brake and found the handle missing. There was nothing there. All at once, Mr. Graham knew that more than anything else in the world, he wanted to get out of that truck. As the end of everything swept toward him, he struggled with the battered door, got it open, and tried to roll out. But as he tumbled from the fast-moving truck, the inside door handle, projecting forward, slipped into the open pocket of his jacket. Mr. Graham's feet touched solid ground only briefly before he was jerked like a hooked fish over the verge of the abyss. Lightly attached to one another, weightless and free, the truck with its open door and Mr. Graham went off altogether into space. He saw the horizon swing in a queer way far up on his right, and to the left, where the earth had been a moment before, was only the sky, a few stars, the tranquil moon floating far below. The rising sun discovered the boy still alive, stirring feebly in the sand. After some time, moaning softly, he got up on his knees. One eye was swollen shut. His left arm hung limply from a dislocated shoulder. When he tried to lift the arm, a wave of pain surged through his body. Nausea rose from his bowels. He waited, and when the pain and sickness subsided, he hugged the injured limb to his chest with his good arm and got slowly to his feet. The pain came again, ebbed, and returned. His shirt hung in tatters from his shoulder. With a shred of it, he made several turns around his left forearm and slung it from his neck. Slowly, tentatively, he started down the bed of the ravine, downhill. Going through a willow thicket, the rags of his shirt caught on the branches. He freed himself by stripping off what was left of the shirt, and trudged on. Not once did he look back or upward. At noon, he found water. Beneath the shade of boulders jammed in the middle of the stream bed lay a basin of quicksand with a pool at its center. The heart-shaped prints of deer led in and out. Billy Joe waded through the mud, went down on his belly, cleared the slime from the surface of the water, and drank. Through most of the afternoon, he lay there. When the sun had moved beyond the canyon wall, he crawled out of the sucking sand and went on. Now he was hungry. He found a bush with red berries like currants and ate them. In a dank and shady place, he found a cluster of plants with large white trumpet-like flowers the color of moonlight. The flowers were fragrant, tender, inviting. He ate them. He walked on, following the downward course of the dry stream bed. When he began to feel a little dizzy, he sat down again to rest. Although it was still day, the new moon could be seen in the slot between the canyon walls, drifting among clouds. Staring at the moon, the boy saw it surrounded with hazy rings, rust-colored. The dark vibrations in the sky hurt his eyes. He looked down at the sand between his legs. The dry sand, scattered with pebbles, seemed alive. The surface of the ground was palpitating softly, steadily, as if breathing, and each pebble, formerly so dull and sun-bleached, now shone like a jewel. He had never seen anything before so beautiful. He passed his free hand before his eyes and saw the bones glowing through his translucent flesh. He stared and stared, and then something off in the corner of his field of vision caught his attention. There was a bush. A bush growing out of the hard, sun-baked mud. And the bush was alive, each of its many branches writhing in a sort of dance, and all clothed in a luminous aura of smoky green, fiery blue, flame-like yellow. As he watched, the bush became larger, more active, brighter and brighter. Suddenly it exploded into fire. Whimpering, Billy Joe pressed his hand to his eyes and felt the joints of his bones grate together like glass. He held himself rigid against the convulsions that swelled with a droning murmur through his body. They grew more powerful, overwhelmed him, possessed him. Yielding, the agony passed out of him and beyond, and all became quiet again, marvelously still. He lowered his hand, opened his eyes. The bush was in place as before, writhing and glowing but not in fire. The walls of the canyon towered over him, leaning in toward him, then moving back. In and then back, but without sound. They were radiant, like heated iron. The moon had passed out of sight. He saw the stars caught in a dense sky like moths in a cobweb, alive, quivering, struggling to escape. He understood their fear, their desperation, and wept in sympathy with their helplessness. He watched, and a meteor passed beneath the web, gliding more slowly than a ship across what seemed an infinite sea of vibrant, curling waves. In the wake of the meteor, streamers of flame expanded with languorous, unhurried ease, fading out as they grew larger, but leaving the sky in some way transmuted, stained by their burning passage. The boy looked down at the bush, at the pebbles on the sand, at his hand. When he looked up again, the meteor had crossed about two-thirds of the interval between canyon walls and was still advancing. Before it passed over the farther wall, he fell asleep. And when he awoke, late the next morning, he remembered all that he had seen, but no longer as anything strange. For everything appeared to him as equally strange. The still-smoking wreckage of a truck which he passed in the middle of the day, with ravens picking at fragments of burnt meat crammed inside the crumpled, blackened steel, this did not seem to Billy Joe in any way extraordinary. Farther down the canyon, he stepped over parts of a human body, an arm encased in the sleeve of a jacket, the shoulder gnawed down to the bone, and a head, the head of a man, separated from its trunk by a blow of some incredible violence. He looked at these things, and he saw them, but did not pause. He shuffled past them without glancing back, neither slowing nor increasing his pace. The ravens watched him go, croaking with satisfaction, and swept down again upon the remnants. They approached their meat in a stylized, formal fashion, with little dancing steps, and covered it under widespread, glossy, blue-black wings. In the afternoon, he came into a larger canyon through which flowed a small stream. The place should have been familiar to the boy. The warm, unpleasant-smelling water, the mud banks encrusted with alkali white as salt, the tamarisk and pickleweed. But he did not recognize it. He drank the water and bathed his eye. The swelling was beginning to go down, and he could open the lids enough to see through. He followed the water. All through the day, clouds gathered in the sky. Wind whistled above the walls, and by evening he could hear from far away the mutter of thunder. At night, whenever he awoke for a few moments, he saw flashes of lightning reflected in the sky. But no rain fell where he was. His hunger made him sick with misery, worse than the pain of his arm and shoulder to which he was now accustomed, or the fiery discomfort of his sunburned back. When morning came, he got up and tried to go on, but could not walk very far. He crawled into the shade of a giant cottonwood tree, long dead, that lay across the stream bed with its roots exposed and its bare limbs pointing up the canyon. The cool, damp sand felt good to the boy, with the water trickling over his feet and ankles. He was not going to walk any more. He would wait now for whatever had to happen. He was tired, and everything was strange. He might not even have heard the coming of the flash flood. It began as a dim, toneless resonance in the distance, like the sound made by a train entering the far end of a very long tunnel. Gradually the vibrations grew in volume until the canyon filled with a dull and heavy roar, but the flood itself did not yet appear. Half conscious, Billy Joe dreamed of home. 1, 2, 3, 4 small gray birds fluttered out of the willows beside the stream and flew in circles to a perch high on the canyon wall. Now. Around the bend, up canyon poured a red snout of liquid mud, which seemed to mumble to itself as it advanced. Sliding greasily forward, the snout of mud dashed against the undercut wall on the outside of the bend, wallowed over ledges, and swung back to the main channel in the center of the canyon floor. The clear perennial stream which flowed there was suddenly buried, extinguished. Swaying from side to side in the rhythm of its pendulous momentum, like a locomotive on uneven rails, the flood rumbled down upon the boy and the dead tree and everything else in its path. Dust sailed into the air as it crashed into mudbanks. Cracks rippled like lightning over the surface of the alluvium, yawning wide apart as chunks and blocks and sections of dried-out earth slid or toppled into the torrent. On the crest of the flood as it came, above the churning debris of bushes, vines, weeds, and logs, floated a delicate and rosy vapor, a fine pink mist suffused with the glow of sunlight. Billy Joe watched the flood surge toward him, saw the light shine on the roiling tomato-red waters. Instinctively he crawled deeper in among the roots of the tree and clung there with his good arm and both legs as the deluge smashed over him. The big cottonwood shuddered under the impact, stirred, swung loose, and rose, becoming buoyant. As the flood widened and deepened, filling the canyon floor from wall to wall, the tree began to float with it, slowly at first, and then faster and faster as it was caught in the central current. The limbs, spreading out on either side like outriggers, kept the tree from rolling as it sailed toward its destiny. Gasping for air, Billy Joe crawled under the trunk and rode it all the way through the canyon, all the way while boulders clashed in the foam beneath him and slabs of sandstone shook free of their ancient fastenings, spalled from the cliffs, and crashed with a sound like thunder into the heave and roar of the flood. He was still leeched to the tree, part drowned but alive, when it caromed off a jutting outcrop at the canyon's mouth, and glided majestically out onto the flow of a wide and gleaming, deep and golden river. Now began for the boy what was for him an unreckoned, uncountable series of days and nights. His life became dreamlike. The nightmare, with its unacceptable disasters, was left behind, submerged in chaos. He lived now a dream, a golden dream which grew day by day more golden, more dreamlike, on the golden water under the inescapable eye of the golden desert sun. He clung to the tree as if it were the only thing he knew. He had neither the thought nor the power to leave it. And as the tree drifted southward and west through the labyrinthine canyons of the river, through the immense silence, the light came down on his naked body from above, from the burnished walls on either side, from the dazzling play and sparkle of the water itself. At first, during the early days, he may have made feeble efforts to cool his body by slipping off the trunk of the tree and floating with it, one arm bent over a limb. But as his strength diminished, he would have found it always more difficult to pull himself out of the water and back onto the trunk. Finally, he must have given up those efforts and remained entirely on the tree, making no move whatever as the rays of the sun, direct and reflected, seared his flesh, baked his brain within its skull, poisoned the marrow of his bones. Each night brought relief, enough to stir his drugged consciousness and arouse his agony. Each day brought the golden sun, more than enough to burn him deeper into the dream. At last he surrendered, and passed through his pain into a deeper state of bliss. 16 days after Mr. Graham's last flight, Billy Joe was discovered by the ferryman at Heights Crossing. He saw the tree lodged against his landing dock, and what resembled a shriveled human figure attached to the trunk of it. He called for help. Carefully, they removed the body, which was covered with a mass of second- and third-degree burns. The boy certainly appeared to be quite dead. But then they detected a trace of life, or thought they did. Someone radioed for an airplane. The boy was flown to a hospital in Flagstaff. The doctors there believed that Billy Joe was still alive. They put him into an oxygen tent and pumped quarts of glucose into his veins. Mrs. Husk was contacted and came down to see him. But he never saw her. He never came back. Never opened his eyes, never spoke. He could not live anymore. And after 3 days, even the strongest of the doctors let him go. Then he died. Mrs. Husk survived, even after the remains of her husband and her lover were found, and with her 2 little daughters went back home to Texas, but not to the farm. That was gone, along with Grandpa. About 1 year after the incident in Utah, she was approached cautiously by a lawyer, an affable young fellow from Austin. After the usual sociable preliminaries, the attorney said that he understood that Mrs. Husk, as inheritor of the estate of her late husband, held a 40% interest in a group of uranium claims known as the Hot Rock Mountain Mineral Development Company. Mrs. Husk said that this was true. The lawyer said that he had been authorized by an interested party to negotiate with Mrs. Husk the purchase of her share in these properties. Mrs. Husk said, "How much?" The lawyer said that he had been authorized to offer Mrs. Husk $4,500, twice what her late husband had paid for them. Mrs. Husk said that she would settle for $150,000. The lawyer smiled and said that he was quite serious. Mrs. Husk said that she was serious, too, and that on second thought perhaps $237,000 would be a more reasonable figure. The lawyer smiled again and revealed confidentially that he had been authorized to offer, if absolutely necessary, as much as $15,000. Mrs. Husk said that $192,761 seemed to her a fair price. The lawyer offered her a cigarette. She took it. He lit it for her with a trim-shaped lighter bearing on its fuselage the emblem of the USAF. They agreed shortly thereafter on the sum of $100,000. Cowboys and Indians. June in the desert. The sun roars down from its track in space with a savage and holy light, a fantastic music in the mind. Up in the mountains, the snow has receded to timberline. Old Tuckanickavats and the other peaks take on a soft spring green along their flanks. The aspen is leafing out. The roads up into the meadows and forests are open again, and all the Moab cattlemen who hold grazing permits up there, and some who don't, are moving their stock out of the desert and into the national forest, where the animals will stay until September and the return of the snow. Springtime on the mountains, summer down here. Yesterday I helped Roy Scobie clear his cows out of Courthouse Wash, which mostly runs to the west of the park, but through the south end of it. We started early, about 6, after a hot breakfast in the morning twilight. 3 of us. Roy, his Basque-hired man, Viviano Jaquez, myself. Roy is a leather-hided, long-connected, sober-sided old man with gray hair, red nose, and yellow teeth. He is kind, gentle, well-meaning but worries too much, takes things too seriously. For instance, he is afraid of having a heart attack, falling off the horse, dying there on the sand, under the sun, among the flies and weeds and indifferent cattle. I'm not inferring this. He told me so. What could I say? I was still young myself, or thought I was, enjoying good health, not yet quite to the beginning of the middle of the journey. I listened gravely as he spoke of death, nodding in an agreement I did not feel. His long yellow fingers holding a cigarette trembled. Roy's no Mormon and not much of a Christian, and does not honestly believe in an afterlife. Yet the manner of death he fears does not sound bad to me. To me it seems like a decent, clean way of taking off. Surely better than the slow rot in a hospital oxygen tent, with rubber tubes stuck up your nose, prick, asshole, with blood transfusions and intravenous feeding, bed sores and bed pans and bad-tempered nurses' aides, the whole nasty routine to which most dying men in our time are condemned. But how could I tell him so? What did I know of it? To me, death was little more than a fascinating abstraction, the conclusion to a syllogism, or the denouement of a stage drama. What do old men who don't believe in heaven think about, I used to wonder. Now we know. They think about their blood pressure, their bladders, their aortas, their lower intestines, ice on the doorstep, too much sun at noon. I met Roy and Viviano at a place called Willow Seep, near the upper end of Courthouse Wash, and there we began the drive. We were only about 10 miles from the stock pens near Moab, but would have to check out all the side canyons along the way. We unloaded the horses from Roy's truck, gave them each a little grain, saddled up, and moved out with the old man in the middle. A fine morning. A sweet, cool, stark, sunlit, silent desert morning. Before the heat moved in, and the deer flies, the sweat, the dust, and the thirst came down on us. Not far down the canyon we found the first small bunch of cows and calves. They saw us coming and trotted off in various directions through the brush, making things more difficult than was really necessary. In the cool of the morning they were feeling lively. Also, not having seen a man or a horse all winter, they were half wild. The little calves had never seen anything like us, and were, understandably, terrified. We collected them all after a time and got them moving together down the wash, pushing them steadily but not fast. Only half the cows wore Roy's brand and earmarks, but in accordance with custom we herded everything we found toward Moab. The other ranchers would do the same, and in the stock pens each man would sort out his own property from the rest. Any cow without a brand, Slick, belonged to the finder. Many a famous cattle outfit had been started with no more than a rope and a good horse. Cooperation is necessary because in this part of Utah there are not many fences. The cattle wander far over the open range, driven by hunger and thirst, and forget who they belong to. Why no fences? Because in much of the canyon country, there is no ground to dig post holes in. Nothing but solid rock. Old Roy had something on his mind. When the sun burst out above the canyon rim, flaring like a white scream, and its hot breath burned my neck, I knew what he was thinking about. The cattle plodded before us, slowing down as the heat rose, reluctant to keep moving. When they stopped, we yelled and whistled at them, beat their gaunt hip bones with our bridle reins, kicked them in the ribs. They jogged ahead, half trotting, and the green dung streamed down their legs. Ugly brutes, bound for a summer in the high meadows and then the slaughterhouse. Too bloody good for them, I was thinking. Side canyons appeared. Viviano took one, I took the other, while Roy stayed with the bunch we already had. The canyon I faced was choked with brush, impossible to ride through. The prickly pear grew knee-high in great clumps, hairy with spines. Scrub oak obstructed the path, the branches of juniper and pinon pine struck at my face, knocked my hat off. I had to tie the horse and go in on foot. The heavy air was swarming with flies, and the numerous trails in the thickets were well beaten and dusty, strewn with cow droppings. Real cattle country, all right. I picked up a club, went on, stooping under the tangle. The canyon was short and boxed in, and at the head was a cow and her calf. I drove them out and back to the main canyon. I was glad to get on my horse and rejoin Viviano and Roy. Viviano was happy that morning. He sang and whistled continually, winked and grinned when he caught my eye, and charged after straying cattle like a maniac, spurring his thin-skinned palomino through the brush, up over rocks, down mud banks, and between trees with what looked to me like complete indifference to life and limb, the vulnerability of the flesh. Not showing off, for I'd seen his exhibitions of recklessness at other times, but simply out of high spirits, for the fun and the hell of it. Bibiano Jaquez, born in the Pyrenees somewhere, he never cared to tell me more, had been imported with his parents into Utah to herd sheep for some congressman's favorite constituent, then drifted from job to job until he came to Roy Scobie's combination dude and cattle ranch. He's a good cowboy, I suppose. At least he knows the basic skills of the trade. Can shoe a horse, rope and brand and castrate a calf, fix a flat tire, stretch barbed wire, dynamite a beaver dam, or lay out an irrigation ditch. His English is about 50% profanity, rough but intelligible, and he can sing, play the guitar, and read your fortune in the cards, the rewards of what I would call his liberal education. He is short, dark, and savage, like most good Basques, with large brown glamorous eyes which seem to appeal to the ladies. From 14 to 45 he pursues them all, and if I can believe his lies, makes out with every one. What else about him? This. He does not understand American clock time and has no sense of responsibility. He is completely and dependably totally unreliable. But, in his favor, he is inexpensive. He is economical. He works full-time 7 days a week for room and board and $100 a month. Employers like that. But it would be false to say that Bibiano is exploited. How can you exploit a man who enjoys his work? He'll work for nothing, almost, if necessary, requiring only a token wage or salary in recognition of his professional status. Not that he never bitches and grumbles. When he isn't singing or whistling or telling lies in some woman's ear, he complains loud and bitterly about his pay, the long hours, the lousy food, the skunks under the bunkhouse, the treacherous and conniving women, the stupid dudes. He threatens to quit, gets drunk, and disappears for a couple of days. But always comes back, or has so far. Poor Bibiano, with so much to his credit, has one problem which he'll never be able to outlive. 2 or 3 beers, and he reveals it to me. He has been infected by the poison of prejudice, infected and victimized. With his dark skin and Spanish accent, he is often taken for a Mexican, which he resents, because he despises Mexicans. He also despises Indians. Even his own heritage. Dumb Bosco, he once called himself. Inadvertently, when drunk, he exposes the wistful desire to somehow disappear and merge into the pale-faced millions who own and operate America. Useless to try and reassure him that he has more to lose than gain by such assimilation. Somewhere, in a way we all know, his pride was damaged and his confidence shaken. In our occasional rambles through the beer halls of Moab, I have not seen him rebuffed in any way. But he may be alert to signals of rejection too subtle for me. In any case, at one time or another, perhaps unknown even to Bibiano himself, the damage was done. And his reaction is the typical one. He responds to prejudice by cultivating a prejudice of his own against those whom he feels are even lower in the American hierarchy than he is. Against the Indians, the Mexicans, the Negroes. He knows where the bottom is. Too late to make a liberal out of Bibiano Jaquez. The sun climbed noon high, the heat grew thick and heavy on our brains, the dust clouded our eyes and mixed with our sweat. Bibiano's white teeth gleam through a kind of pancake makeup of sweat and dirt when he laughs at me or at the hard-mouthed beast I'm riding. The cows groan against the forced migration as if they know where it will eventually bring them. I think of the second movement from Beethoven's Eroica.
Marcia funebre.
My canteen is nearly empty, and I'm afraid to drink what little water is left. There may never be any more. I'd like to cave in for a while, crawl under yonder cottonwood, and die peacefully in the shade, drinking dust. I look aside covertly under my hat brim at old man Scobie, who thinks he is going to have a heart attack and fall off his horse. He rides steadily forward, eyes sad and thoughtful, watching the green rumps of his cattle, cigarette hanging from his lower lip, flicking the reins casually back and forth across the mane of his equally thoughtful, abstracted horse. Lunchtime, maybe, I think, glancing at the sun. But nobody says anything about lunch. Maybe they aren't even planning to stop for lunch. Maybe they aren't human. Some of the cows bunched up in the shade under an overhang in the canyon wall. They refused to move. Their calves stumbled close to them, bawling piteously. The drive was starting to drag. Have mercy on us all, I thought. But Viviano, like a sun-crazed madman, rode savagely into the cattle, screaming and whistling, lashing at the cows with a length of rope.
"Crazy son of my bitches!" he was screaming. "Let's pick up the feet!"
Roy raised a hand.
"That's all right, Viviano," he said. "We'll take a break now. Don't want to run them little beeves right into the ground."
Good man, I thought, heading at once for the nearest shade, where I tied my horse to a log, unsaddled, and dropped. I was too hot and tired at first even to care about food or water. Viviano and Roy joined me, unhurried, lay down in the shade nearby and lit up cigarettes. Above us was the green canopy of the cottonwood tree, filtering the light to a tolerable dimness. A few red ants crawled over my belly. I didn't care. "Dingo said," I said to myself. I finished my water. But appeasing thirst brought back hunger. Who brought the lunch? I began to worry, realizing for the first time that no one had said a word about it yet. I didn't say anything either. But I was worried.
"I'm worried," old Roy said.
"Tengo mucho hambre, hombre. I'm worried, too.
How did it go in that other language?
Fon? Je fon? Je suis famine?"
I looked toward Viviano. He was already asleep, the fancy $20 Stetson over his eyes, a pair of flies circling above his open mouth. For a hat band, he wore a sterling silver chain. In the mouth, a golden tooth. The goddamned lady killer.
"You know what happened to Ernie Fay?"
Roy said, evidently addressing me, though he was staring up at the leaves.
"No," I said, "what happened to him?" "You wouldn't know him. This happened 3 years ago."
Roy paused.
"He was picking peaches one day in his own backyard, taking it easy, and he had a stroke. When his wife